Brigman shifted his weight. Granite, polished smooth, and fits so closely together you can't even slide a knife blade between the blocks. Dwarf work, I'd guess, from before the Fall of the Riders. I'd also guess that the walls are filled with packed rubble, but I can't say for sure since we haven't cracked the outer sheathing yet. They extend at least 12 feet below ground, and probably more, which means we can't tunnel under them, or weaken them with sapping. Stepping forward, Brigman pointed at the manors to the north and west. Most of the nobles have retreated into Aros, but they left men behind to protect their property. They've given us some trouble, attacking our scouts, stealing our horses, that sort of thing. We captured 2 of the estates early on. He indicated a pair of burnt-out husks a few miles away. But holding them was more trouble than it was worth, so we sacked them and put them to the torch. Unfortunately, we don't have enough men to secure the rest. Baldur spoke then. Why do the canals feed into Aros? It doesn't look as if they're used for watering crops. You don't need to water here, lad, any more than a Northman needs to cart in snow during the winter. Staying dry is more a problem than not. Then what are they used for? Roran inquired. And where do they come from? You can't expect me to believe the water is drawn from the Jeep River so many leagues away.
Hardly, scoffed Brigman.
There are lakes in the marshes north of us. It's brackish, unwholesome water, but the people here are accustomed to it. A single channel carries it from the marshes to a point about 3 miles away. There the channel divides into the 3 canals you see here, and they run over a series of falls which power the mills that grind flour for the city. The peasants cart their grain to the mills at harvest time, and then the sacks of flour are loaded onto barges and floated down to Aros. It's also a handy way of moving other goods, like timber and wine, from the manor houses to the city. Roran rubbed the back of his neck as he continued to examine Aros. What Brigman had told him intrigued him, but he was not sure how it could help. Is there anything else of significance in the surrounding countryside? He asked. Only a slate mine, farther south along the coast. He grunted, still thinking. I want to visit the mills, he said. But first, I want to hear a full account of your time here, and I want to know how well provisioned we are with everything from arrows to biscuits. If you'll follow me, Stronghammer. The next hour, Roran spent in conference with Brigman and 2 of his lieutenants, listening and asking questions as they recounted each of the assaults they had launched against the city walls, as well as cataloguing the stocks of supplies left to the warriors under his command. At least we're not short of weapons, Roran thought, as he counted the number of dead. Yet even if Nasawada had not set a time limit upon his mission, the men and horses did not have enough food to stay camped before Aros for more than another week. Many of the facts and figures that Brigman and his lackeys related came from writing on scrolls of parchment. Roran strove to conceal the fact that he could not decipher the rows of angular black marks by insisting that the men read everything to him. But it irritated him that he was at the mercy of others. Nasawada was right, he realized. I have to learn to read, else I cannot tell if someone is lying to me when they say that a piece of parchment says one thing or another. Maybe Khan can teach me on our return to the Varden. The more Roran learned about Aros, the more he began to sympathize with Brigman's plight. Capturing the city was a daunting task with no obvious solution. Despite his dislike for the man, Roran thought that the captain had done as well as could be expected under the circumstances. He had failed, Roran believed, not because he was an incompetent commander, but because he lacked the 2 qualities that had granted Roran victory time and time again: daring and imagination. Upon finishing his review, Roran and his 5 companions rode with Brigman to inspect Aros's walls and gates from a closer but still safe distance. Sitting in a saddle again was incredibly painful for Roran, but he bore it without complaint. As their steeds clattered onto the stone-paved road next to the camp and began to trot toward the city, Roran noticed that on occasion the horses' hoofs produced a peculiar noise when they struck the ground. He remembered hearing a similar sound and being bothered by it during their final day of traveling. Looking down, he saw that the flat stones that formed the surface of the road seemed to be set within tarnished silver, the veins of which formed an irregular cobweb-like pattern. Roran called out to Brigman and asked him about it, whereupon Brigman shouted, "The dirt here makes for poor mortar, so instead they use lead to hold the stones in place." Roran's initial reaction was disbelief, but Brigman appeared serious. He found it astonishing that any metal could be so common that people would squander it on building a road. So they trotted down the lane of stone and lead toward the gleaming city beyond. They studied Aros's defenses with great attentiveness, but their increased proximity revealed nothing new, and only served to reinforce Roran's impression that the city was nigh on impregnable. He guided his horse over to Khan's. The magician was staring at Aros with a glazed expression, his lips moving silently as if he were talking to himself. Roran waited until he stopped, then quietly asked, "Are there any spells on the gates?"
"I think so," Khan replied, equally subdued. "But I'm not sure how many, or what their intended purpose is. I'll need more time to tease out the answers."
"Why is it so difficult?"
"It's not, really. Most spells are easy to detect, unless someone has made an effort to hide them. And even then, the magic usually leaves certain telltale traces, if you know what to look for. My concern is that one or more of the spells might be traps, set to prevent people from meddling with the gate's enchantments. If that's so, and I approach them directly, I'll be sure to trigger them. And who knows what will happen? I might dissolve into a puddle before your very eyes, which is a fate I would rather avoid if I had my way."
"Do you want to stay here while we continue on?" Khan shook his head.
"I don't think it would be wise to leave you unguarded while we're away from camp. I'll return after sundown and see what I can do then. Besides, it would help if I were closer to the gates, and I don't dare go any nearer now, when I'm in plain sight of the sentinels."
"As you wish." When Roran was satisfied they had learned everything they could by looking at the city, he had Brigman lead them to the nearest set of mills. They were much as Brigman had described. The water in the canal flowed over 3 consecutive 20-foot falls. At the base of each fall was a water wheel, edged with buckets. The water splashed into the buckets, driving the machine round and round. The wheels were connected by thick axles to 3 identical buildings that stood stacked one above the other along the terraced bank, and which contained the massive grindstones needed to produce the flour for Aros's population. Though the wheels were moving, Roran could tell they were disengaged from the complex arrangement of gears hidden inside the buildings, for he did not hear the rumble of the grindstones turning in their places. He dismounted by the lowest mill and walked up the path between the buildings, eyeing the sluice gates that were above the falls and that controlled the amount of water released into them. The gates were open, but a deep pool of water still lay beneath each of the 3 slowly spinning wheels. He stopped halfway up the hill and planted his feet on the edge of the soft grassy bank, crossed his arms, and tucked his chin against his chest, while he pondered how he could possibly capture Aros. That there was a trick or a strategy that would allow him to crack open the city like a ripe gourd, he was confident. But the solution eluded him. He thought until he was tired of thinking, and then he gave himself over to the creaking of the turning axles and the splashing of the falling water. Soothing as those sounds were, a thorn of unease still rankled him, for the place reminded him of Dempton's mill in Therensford, where he had gone to work the day the Razak had burned down his home and tortured his father, mortally wounding him. Roran tried to ignore the memory, but it stayed with him, twisting in his gut. "If only I had waited another few hours to leave, I could have saved him." Then the more practical part of Roran replied, "Yes, and the Razak would have killed me before I could have even raised a hand. Without Aragorn to protect me, I would have been as helpless as a newborn babe." With a quiet step, Baldur joined him by the edge of the canal. "The others are wondering. Have you decided on a plan?" he asked.
"I have ideas, but no plan. What of you?"
Baldur crossed his arms as well.
"We could wait for Nasawada to send Aragorn and Saphira to our aid."
"Bah!"
For a while they watched the never-ending motion of the water below them.
Then Baldur said,
"What if you just ask them to surrender? Maybe they'll be so frightened when they hear your name, they'll throw open the gates, fall at your feet, and beg for mercy."
Roran chuckled briefly. "I doubt word of me has reached all the way to Aros. Still," he ran his fingers through his beard, "it might be worth a try, to put them off balance, if nothing else. Even if we gain entrance to the city, can we hold it with so few men?" "Maybe, maybe not." A pause grew between them. Then Baldur said, "How far we have come." "Aye." Again, the only sound was that of the water and of the turning wheels. Finally, Baldur said, "The snowmelt must not be as great here as it is at home. Otherwise the wheels would be half under water come springtime." Roran shook his head. "It doesn't matter how much snow or rain they get. The sluice gates can be used to limit the amount of water that runs over the wheels, so they don't turn too fast. But once the water rises to the top of the gates? Hopefully the day's grinding is finished by then. But in any case, you uncouple the gears, raise the gates, and..." Roran trailed off as a series of images flashed through his mind, and his whole body flushed with warmth, as if he had drunk an entire tankard of mead in a single gulp. "Could I?" he thought wildly. "Would it really work, or..." "It doesn't matter. We have to try. What else can we do?" He strode out to the center of the berm that held back the middlemost pond, and grasped the spokes that stuck out from the tall wooden screw used to raise and lower the sluice gate. The screw was stiff and hard to move, even though he set his shoulder against it and pushed with all his weight. "Help me," he said to Baldur, who had remained on the bank, watching with puzzled interest. Baldur carefully made his way to where Roran stood. Together, they managed to close the sluice gate. Then, refusing to answer any questions, Roran insisted that they do the same with both the uppermost and the lowermost gates. When all three were firmly shut, Roran walked back to Karn, Brigman, and the others, and motioned for them to climb off their horses and gather around him. He tapped the head of his hammer while he waited, suddenly feeling unreasonably impatient.
"Well?" Brigman demanded once they were in place.
Roran looked each of them in the eyes to make sure that he had their undivided attention. Then he said,
"Right, this is what we're going to do."
And he began to talk quickly and intensely for a full half hour, explaining everything that had occurred to him in that one revelatory instant. As he spoke, Mandel began to grin, and though they remained more serious, Baldur, Delwyn, and Hammond also appeared excited by the audacious nature of the scheme he outlined. Their response gratified Roran. He had done much to earn their trust, and he was pleased to know that he could still count on their support. His only fear was that he might let them down. Of all the fates he could imagine, only losing Katrina seemed worse. Karn, on the other hand, appeared somewhat doubtful. This Roran had expected, but the magician's doubt was slight compared with Brigman's incredulity.
"You're mad!" he exclaimed, once Roran had finished. "It'll never succeed!"
"You take that back," said Mandel, and jumped forward, his fists clenched. "Why, Roran's won more battles than you've ever fought in, and he did it without all the warriors you've had to order around."
Brigman snarled, his bare upper lip curling like a snake.
"You little whelp! I'll teach you a lesson in respect you'll never forget."
Roran pushed Mandel back before the younger man could attack Brigman.
"Oi!" growled Roran. "Behave yourself."
With a surly look, Mandel ceased resisting, but he continued to glower at Brigman, who sneered at him in return.
"It's an outlandish plan, to be sure," said Delwyn, "but then your outlandish plans have served us well in the past."
The other men from Carvajal made sounds of agreement. Karn nodded and said,
"Maybe it will work, and maybe it won't. I don't know. In any event, it's certain to catch our enemies by surprise, and I have to admit, I'm rather curious to see what will happen. Nothing like this has ever been tried before."
Roran smiled slightly. Addressing Brigman, he said,
"To continue as before, now that would be mad. We have only 2.5 days to seize Aros. Ordinary methods won't suffice, so we must hazard the extraordinary."
"That may be," muttered Brigman. But this is a ridiculous venture that will kill many a good man, and for no reason other than to demonstrate your supposed cleverness."
His smile widening, Roran moved toward Brigman, until only a few inches separated them.
"You don't have to agree with me, Brigman. You only have to do what you're told. Now, will you follow my orders, or not?"
The air between them grew warm from their breath, and from the heat radiating off their skin. Brigman gritted his teeth and twisted his spear even more vigorously than before. But then his gaze wavered, and he backed away.
"Blast you," he said. "I'll be your dog for the while, Stronghammer. But there'll be a reckoning on this soon enough, just you watch, and then you'll have to answer for your decisions."
"As long as we capture Aros," thought Roran, "I don't care."
"Mount up," he shouted. "We have work to do, and little time to do it in. Hurry, hurry, hurry!"
Dras Leona. The sun was climbing into the sky, as was Sathira, when from his place on her back, Aragorn spotted Helgrind on the edge of the northern horizon. He felt a surge of loathing as he beheld the distant spike of rock, which rose from the surrounding landscape like a single jagged tooth. So many of his most unpleasant memories were associated with Helgrind, he wished he could destroy it and see its bare grey spires fall crashing to the ground. Sephira was more indifferent to the dark tower of stone, but he could tell that she, too, disliked being near it. By the time evening arrived, Helgrind lay behind them, while Dras Leona lay before them, next to Leona Lake, where dozens of ships and boats bobbed at anchor. The low, broad city was as densely built and inhospitable as Aragorn remembered, with its narrow, crooked streets and filthy hovels packed close together against the yellow mud wall that ringed the center of the city, and behind the wall, the towering shape of Dras Leona's immense cathedral, black and barbed, where the priests of Helgrind conducted their gruesome rituals. A stream of refugees trailed along the road to the north, people fleeing the soon-to-be-besieged city for Tirm or Urabain, where they might find at least temporary safety from the Varden's inexorable advance. Dras Leona seemed as foul and evil to Aragorn as when he had first visited it, and it aroused in him a lust for destruction such as he had not felt at either Feinster or Bellatona. Here he wanted to lay waste with fire and sword, to lash out with all of the terrible, unnatural energies that were at his disposal, and to indulge in every savage urge, and leave behind him nothing but a pit of smoking, blood-soaked ashes. For the poor and the crippled and the enslaved who lived within the confines of Dras Leona, he had some sympathy, but he was wholly convinced of the city's corruption, and believed that the best thing would be to raise it, and rebuild it without the taint of perversity the religion of Helgrind had infected it with. As he fantasized about tearing down the cathedral with Sephira's help, it occurred to him to wonder if the religion of the priests who practiced self-mutilation had a name. His study of the ancient language had taught him to appreciate the importance of names. Names were power. Names were understanding. And until he knew the name of the religion, he would not be able to fully apprehend its true nature. In the waning light, the Varden settled on a series of cultivated fields just southeast of Dras Leona, where the land rose up to a slight plateau, which would provide them with a modicum of protection should the enemy charge their position. The men were weary from marching, but Nasawada put them to work fortifying the camp, as well as assembling the mighty engines of war they had brought with them all the long way from Surda. Aragorn threw himself into the work with a will. First, he joined a team of men who were flattening the fields of wheat and barley, using planks with long loops of rope attached. It would have been faster to side the grain, either with steel or magic, but the stubble that remained would be dangerous and uncomfortable to walk over, much less to sleep upon. As it was, the compacted stalks formed a soft, springy surface, as fine as any mattress, and one far preferable to the bare ground they were accustomed to. Aragorn labored alongside the other men for almost an hour, at which point they had cleared enough space for the tents of the Varden. Then he helped in the construction of a siege tower. His greater-than-normal strength allowed him to shift beams that otherwise would have taken several warriors to move. Thus he was able to speed the process. A few of the dwarves, who were still with the Varden, oversaw the raising of the tower, for the engines were of their design. Saphira helped as well. With her teeth and claws, she gouged deep trenches in the ground, and piled the removed earth into embankments around the camp, accomplishing more in a few minutes than 100 men could have in a whole day. And with the fire from her maw and mighty sweeps of her tail, she leveled trees, fences, walls, houses, and everything else around the Varden that might give their foes cover. In all, she presented a picture of fearsome devastation, sufficient to inspire trepidation in even the bravest of souls. It was late at night when the Varden finally finished their preparations, and Nasawada ordered the men, dwarves, and Urgals to bed. Retiring to his tent, Aragorn meditated until his mind was clear, as had become his habit. Instead of practicing his penmanship afterward, he spent the next few hours reviewing the spells he thought he might need the following day, as well as inventing new ones to address the specific challenges Drasleona presented. When he felt ready for the battle to come, he abandoned himself to his waking dreams, which were more varied and energetic than usual. But despite his meditation, the prospect of the approaching action stirred his blood and would not allow him to relax. As always, the waiting and the uncertainty were the most difficult parts for him to bear, and he wished he were already in the midst of the fray, where he would have no time to worry about what might happen. Saphira was equally restless. From her, he caught snatches of dreams that involved biting and tearing, and he could tell that she was looking forward to the fierce pleasure of battle. Her mood influenced his to a certain degree, but not enough to make him entirely forget his apprehension. All too soon, morning arrived, and the Varden assembled before the exposed outskirts of Drasleona. The army was an imposing sight, but Aragorn's admiration was tempered by his observation of the warriors' notched swords, dented helms, and battered shields, as well as the poorly repaired rents in their padded tunics and mail hauberks. If they succeeded in capturing Drasleona, they would be able to replace some of their equipment, as they had at Bellatona and before that, Feinster. But there was no replacing the men who bore them. "The longer this drags on," he said to Saphira, "the easier it will be for Galbatorix to defeat us when we arrive at Urubane."
"Then we must not delay," she replied.
Aragorn sat astride her, next to Nasawada, who was garbed in full armour and mounted upon her fiery black charger, Battlestorm. Arrayed around them were his 12 elven guards, as well as an equal number of Nasawada's guards, the Nighthawks, increased from her normal allotment of 6 for the duration of the battle. The elves were on foot, for they refused to ride any steeds but those they had raised and trained themselves, while all of the Nighthawks were mounted, including the Urgals. 10 yards to the right were King Orin and his hand-picked retinue of warriors, each of whom had a colourful plume attached to the crest of his helm. Nahim, the commander of the dwarves, and Garjvag were both with their respective troops. After exchanging nods, Nasawada and King Orin spurred their mounts forward and trotted away from the main body of the Varden toward the city. With his left hand, Aragorn clutched the neck spike in front of him as Saphira followed. Nasawada and King Orin drew to a halt before they passed among the ramshackle buildings. At their signal, 2 heralds, one carrying the Varden standard, the other Surda's, rode forth up the narrow street that ran through the maze of hovels to Drasleona's southern gate. Aragorn frowned as he watched the heralds advance. The city seemed unnaturally empty and quiet. No one was visible in the whole of Drasleona, not even upon the battlements of the thick yellow wall, where hundreds of Galbatorix's soldiers ought to be stationed.
"The air smells wrong," said Saphira,
and she growled ever so slightly, drawing Nasawada's attention. At the base of the wall, the Varden's herald called forth, in a voice that carried all the way back to Aragorn and Saphira,
"Hail! In the name of Lady Nasawada of the Varden, and King Orin of Surda, as well as all free peoples of Alagaesia, we bid you open your gates,
so we may deliver a message of import unto your lord and master, Marcus Tabor. By it he may hope to profit greatly, as may every man, woman, and child within Drasleona." From behind the wall, a man who could not be seen replied, "These gates shall not open. State your message where you stand." "Speak you for Lord Tabor?" "I do." "Then we charge you to remind him that discussions of statesmanship are more properly pursued in the privacy of one's own chambers, rather than in the open, where any might hear." "I take no orders from you, lackey. Deliver your message, and quickly too, ere I lose patience and fill you with arrows." Aragorn was impressed. The herald did not appear flustered or cowed by the threat, but continued without hesitation. "As you wish. Our liege lords offer peace and friendship to Lord Tabor and all the people of Drasleona. We have no argument with you, only with Galbatorix, and we would not fight you if we had the choice. Have we not a common cause? Many of us once lived in the Empire, and we left only because Galbatorix's cruel reign drove us from our lands. We are your kin, in blood and in spirit. Join forces with us, and we may yet free ourselves of the usurper who now sits in Urabane. Should you accept our offer, our liege lords do guarantee the safety of Lord Tabor and his family, as well as whoever else may now be in the service of the Empire, although none will be allowed to maintain their position if they have given oaths that cannot be broken. And if your oaths will not let you aid us, then at least do not hinder us. Raise your gates and lay down your swords, and we promise you will come to no harm. But try to bar us, and we shall sweep you aside like so much chaff. For none can withstand the might of our army, nor that of Aragorn's Shadeslayer and the dragon Saphira." At the sound of her name, Saphira raised her head and loosed a terrifying roar. Above the gate, Aragorn saw a tall, cloaked figure climb onto the battlements and stand between two merlins, staring over the heralds towards Saphira. Aragorn squinted, but he could not make out the man's face. Four other black-robed people joined the man, and those Aragorn knew for priests of Helgrind by their truncated forms. One was missing a forearm, two were missing a leg each, and the last of their company was missing an arm and both legs, and was carried by his or her companions on a small padded litter. The cloaked man threw back his head and uttered a peal of laughter that crashed and boomed with thunderous force. Below him, the heralds struggled to control their mounts as the horses reared and tried to bolt. Aragorn's stomach sank, and he gripped the hilt of Brisinga, ready to draw it at a moment's notice.
"None can withstand your might," said the man, his voice echoing off the buildings. "You have an overly high opinion of yourselves, I think." And with a gigantic bellow, the glittering red mass of thorn leaped from the streets below onto the roof of a house, piercing the wooden shingles with his talons. The dragon spread his huge claw-tipped wings, opened his crimson maw, and raked the sky with a sheet of rippling flame. In a mocking voice, Murtagh, for it was Murtagh, Aragorn realized, added, "Dash yourselves against the walls all you want. You will never take Drasleona, not so long as Thorn and I are here to defend it. Send your finest warriors and magicians to fight us, and they will die, each and every one. That I promise. There isn't a man among you who can best us, not even you, brother. Run back to your hiding places before it is too late, and pray that Galbatorix does not venture forth to deal with you himself. Otherwise death and sorrow will be your only reward."
A Toss of the Bones.
"Sir, sir, the gate's opening!"
Roran looked up from the map he was studying as one of the camp sentinels burst into the tent, red-faced and panting.
"Which gate?" Roran asked, a deadly calm settling over him. "Be precise."
He put aside the rod he had been using to measure distances.
"The one closest to us, sir,
on the road, not the canal.
Pulling his hammer out from under his belt, Roran left the tent and ran through the camp to its southern edge. There, he trained his gaze on Aros. To his dismay, he saw several hundred horsemen pouring out of the city, their brightly coloured pennants snapping in the wind as they assembled in a broad formation before the black maw of the open gateway.
"They'll cut us to pieces," Roran thought, despairing.
Only 150 or so of his men remained in the camp, and many were wounded and unable to fight. All the rest were at the mills he had visited the previous day, or at the slate mine farther down the coast, or along the banks of the westernmost canal, searching for the barges that were needed if his plan was to succeed. None of the warriors could be recalled in time to fend off the horsemen. When he sent the men on their missions, Roran had been aware that he was leaving the camp vulnerable to a counterattack. However, he had hoped that the city folk would be too cowed by the recent assaults on their walls to attempt anything so daring, and that the warriors he had kept with him would be sufficient to convince any distant observers that the main body of his force was still stationed among the tents. The first of those assumptions, it seemed, had most definitely proven to be a mistake. Whether the defenders of Aros were aware of his ruse, he was not entirely sure, but he thought it likely, given the rather limited number of horsemen gathering in front of the city. If the soldiers or their commanders had anticipated facing the full strength of Roran's company, he would have expected them to field twice as many troops. In either event, he still had to figure out a way to stave off their attack and save his men from being slaughtered. Baldur, Khan, and Brigman ran up, weapons in hand. As Khan hastily donned a mail shirt, Baldur said, "What do we do?"
"There's nothing we can do," said Brigman. "You've doomed this whole expedition with your foolishness, Stronghammer. We have to flee now, before those cursed riders are upon us."
Roran spat on the ground.
"Retreat? We'll not retreat.
The men can't escape on foot, and even if they could, I won't abandon our wounded."
"Don't you understand? We've lost here. If we stay, we'll be killed, or worse, taken prisoner."
"Leave it, Brigman. I'm not about to turn tail and run."
"Why not? So you don't have to admit you failed? Because you hope to salvage something of your honour in one final pointless battle? Is that it? Can't you see that you'll only be causing the Varden even greater harm?"
By the base of the city, the horsemen raised their swords and spears over their heads, and with a chorus of whoops and shouts that were audible even over the distance, dug their spurs into their steeds and began to thunder across the sloping plain toward the Varden's encampment. Brigman resumed his tirade.
"I won't let you squander our lives merely to assuage your pride. Stay if you must, but quiet!"
Roran bellowed. "Keep your muzzles shut or I'll shut it for you. Baldur, watch him. If he does anything you don't like, let him feel the point of your sword." Brigman swelled with anger, but he held his tongue as Baldur raised his sword and aimed it at Brigman's breast. Roran guessed that he had maybe 5 minutes to decide upon a course of action, 5 minutes in which so much hung in the balance. He tried to imagine how they could kill or maim enough of the horsemen to drive them away, but almost immediately he discounted the possibility. There was nowhere to herd the onrushing cavalry where his men might have the advantage. The land was too flat, too empty, for any such manoeuvres.
"We can't win if we fight, so what if we scare them? But how? Fire?"
"Fire might prove as deadly to friend as to foe. Besides, the damp grass would only smoulder."
"Smoke? No, that's of no help."
He glanced over at Khan.
"Can you conjure up an image of Sephira and have her roar and breathe fire as if she were really here?"
The spellcaster's thin cheeks drained of colour. He shook his head, his expression panicky.
"Maybe. I don't know. I've never tried before. I'd be creating an image of her from memory. It might not even look like a living creature."
He nodded toward the line of galloping horsemen.
"They'd know something was wrong."
Roran dug his nails into his palm. 4 minutes remained, if that.
"It might be worth a try," he muttered. "We just need to distract them, confuse them."
He glanced up at the sky, hoping to see a curtain of rain sweeping toward the camp. But alas, a pair of attenuated clouds drifting high above was the only formation visible.
confusion, uncertainty, doubt. What is it people fear? The unknown. The things they don't understand, that's what.
In an instant, Roran thought of a half dozen schemes to undermine the confidence of their foes, each more outlandish than the last, until he struck upon an idea that was so simple and so daring, it seemed perfect. Besides, unlike the others, it appealed to his ego, for it required the participation of only one other person. Calm.
"Order the men to hide in their tents," he shouted, already beginning to move, "and tell them to keep quiet. I don't want to hear so much as a peep from them, unless we're attacked."
Going to the nearest tent, which was empty, Roran jammed his hammer back under his belt, and grabbed a dirty woolen blanket from one of the piles of bedding on the ground. Then he ran to a cook fire and scooped up a wide, stump-like section of log the warriors had been using as a stool. With the log under one arm and the blanket thrown over the opposite shoulder, Roran sprinted out of the camp toward a slight mound, perhaps 100 feet in front of the tents.
"Someone get me a set of knuckle bones and a horn of mead," he called, "and fetch me the table my maps are on. Now, blast it, now!"
Behind him, he heard a tumult of footsteps and jangling equipment as the men rushed to conceal themselves inside their tents. An eerie silence fell over the camp a few seconds later, save for the noise created by the men collecting the items he had requested. Roran did not waste time looking back. At the crest of the mound, he set the log upright on its thicker end and twisted it back and forth several times to ensure that it would not wobble beneath him. When he was satisfied it was stable, he sat on it and looked out over the sloping field toward the charging horsemen. 3 minutes or less remained until they would arrive. Through the wood beneath him, he could feel the drumming of the horses' hooves, the sensation growing stronger every second.
"Where are the knuckle bones and mead?"
he shouted, without taking his eyes off the cavalry. He smoothed his beard with a quick pass of his hand and tugged on the hem of his tunic. Fear made him wish he were wearing his mail hauberk, but the colder, more cunning part of his mind reasoned that it would cause his enemies even greater apprehension to see him sitting there with no armor, as if he were totally at his ease. The same part of his mind also convinced him to leave his hammer tucked in his belt, so it would appear he felt safe in the presence of the soldiers.
"Sorry," Khan said breathlessly as he ran up to Roran, along with a man who was carrying the small folding table from Roran's tent.
They placed the table before him and spread the blanket over it, whereupon Khan handed Roran a horn half full of mead, as well as a leather cup containing the usual 5 knuckle bones.
"Go on, get out of here," he said.
Khan turned to leave, but Roran caught him by the arm.
"Can you make the air shimmer on either side of me, as it does above a fire in a cold winter's day?"
Khan's eyes narrowed.
"Possibly, but what good? Just do it if you can. Now go, hide yourself."
As the lanky magician sprinted back toward the camp, Roran shook the knuckle bones in the cup, then poured them out onto the table, and began to play by himself, tossing the bones into the air, first one, then two, then three, and so forth, and catching them on the back of his hand. His father, Garrow, had often amused himself in a like manner, while smoking his pipe and sitting in a rickety old chair on the porch of their house during the long summer evenings of Palancar Valley. Sometimes Roran had played with him, and when he did, he usually lost. But mostly, Garrow had preferred to compete against himself. Though his heart was thumping hard and fast, and his palms were slick with sweat, Roran strove to maintain a calm demeanor. If his gambit was to have the slightest chance of success, he had to comport himself with an air of unbreakable confidence, regardless of his actual emotions. He kept his gaze focused on the knuckle bones, and refused to look up, even as the horsemen drew closer and closer. The sound of the galloping animals swelled, until he became convinced that they were going to ride right over him. "What a strange way to die," he thought, and smiled grimly. Then he thought of Katrina and of their unborn child, and he took comfort in the knowledge that should he die, his bloodline would continue. It was not immortality such as Aragorn possessed, but it was an immortality of a sort, and it would have to suffice. At the last moment, when the cavalry was only a few yards away from the table, someone shouted,
"Whoa! Whoa there! Rein in your horses! I say rein in your horses!"
and with a clatter of buckles and creaking leather, the champing line of animals reluctantly slowed to a halt. And still Roran kept his eyes angled downward. He sipped the pungent mead, then tossed the bones again, and caught two of them on the back of his hand, where they lay rocking on the ridges of his tendons. The aroma of freshly overturned soil wafted over him, warm and comforting, along with the distinctly less pleasant smell of lathered horseflesh.
"Ho there, my fine fellow," said the same man who had ordered the soldiers to halt. "Ho there, I say. Who are you to sit here this splendid morning drinking and enjoying a merry game of chance, as if you hadn't a care in the world? Do we not merit the courtesy of being met with drawn swords? Who are you, I say?"
Slowly, as if he had just noticed the presence of the soldiers and considered it to be of little importance, Roran raised his gaze from the table to regard a small bearded man with a flamboyantly plumed helm who sat before him on an enormous black warhorse, which was heaving like a pair of bellows.
"I'm nobody's fine fellow, and certainly not yours," Roran said, making no effort to conceal his dislike at being addressed in such a familiar manner. "Who are you, I might ask, to interrupt my game so rudely?"
The long, striped feathers mounted atop the man's helm bobbed and fluttered as he looked Roran over, as if Roran were an unfamiliar creature he had encountered while hunting.
"Tharos the Quick is my name, Captain of the Guard. Rude as you are, I must tell you it would grieve me mightily to kill a man as bold as yourself without knowing his name."
As if to emphasize his words, Tharos lowered the spear he held until it was pointing at Roran. Three rows of riders were clustered close behind Tharos. Among their numbers, Roran spied a slim, hook-nosed man, with the emaciated face and arms, which were bare to the shoulders, that Roran had come to associate with the spellcasters of the Varden. Very suddenly, he found himself hoping that Khan had succeeded in making the air shimmer. However, he dared not turn his head to look.
"Stronghammer is my name," he said.
With a single deft movement, he gathered up the knuckle bones, tossed them skyward, and caught three on his hand.
"Roran Stronghammer, and Aragorn Shadeslayer is my cousin. You might have heard mention of him, if not of me."
A rustle of unease spread among the line of horsemen, and Roran thought he saw Tharos's eyes widen for an instant.
"An impressive claim, that. But how can we be sure of its veracity? Any man might say he is another if it served his purpose."
Roran drew his hammer and slammed it down on the table with a muffled thump. Then, ignoring the soldiers, he resumed his game. He uttered a noise of disgust as two of the bones fell from the back of his hand, costing him the round.
"Ah," said Tharos, and coughed, clearing his throat. "You have a most illustrious reputation, Stronghammer, although some argue that it has been exaggerated beyond all reason. Is it true, for example, that you single-handedly felled nigh on 300 men in the village of Deldorad in Cirda? I never learned what the place was called, but if Deldorad it was, then yes, I slew many a soldier there. It was only 193, however, and I was well guarded by my own men while I fought."
"Only 193? Tharos said in a wondering tone.
"You are too modest, Stronghammer. Such a feat might earn a man a place in many a song and story."
Roran shrugged and lifted the horn to his mouth, feigning the action of swallowing, for he could not afford to have his mind clouded by the potent dwarf brew.
"I fight to win, not to lose. Let me offer you a drink, as one warrior to another," he said, and extended the horn toward Tharos.
The short warrior hesitated, and his eyes darted toward the spellcaster behind him for a second. Then he wet his lips and said,
"Perhaps I will at that."
Dismounting his charger, Tharos handed his spear to one of the other soldiers, pulled off his gauntlets, and walked over to the table, where he cautiously accepted the horn from Roran. Tharos sniffed at the mead, then downed a hearty quaff. The feathers on his helm quivered as he grimaced.
"It's not to your liking?" Roran asked, amused. "I confess these mountain drinks are too harsh for my tongue," Tharos said, returning the horn to Roran. "I much prefer the wines of our fields. They are warm and mellow,
and less likely to strip a man of his senses. 'Tis sweet as mother's milk to me, Roran lied. I drink it morning, noon and night. Donning his gloves once again, Tharos returned to the side of his horse, hauled himself into the saddle, and took back his spear from the soldier who had been holding it for him. He directed another glance toward the hook-nosed spellcaster behind him, whose complexion, Roran noticed, had acquired a deathly cast in the brief span since Tharos had set foot on the ground. Tharos must have noticed the change in his magician as well, for his own expression became strained. "My thanks for your hospitality, Roran Stronghammer," he said, raising his voice so that his entire troop could hear. "Mayhap I will soon have the honor of entertaining you within the walls of Aros. If so, I promise to serve you the finest wines from my family's estate, and perhaps with them I will be able to wean you off such barbaric milk as you have there. I think you will find our wine has much to recommend it. We let it age in oaken casks for months or sometimes even years. It would be a pity if all that work were wasted, and the casks were knocked open, and the wine were allowed to run out into the streets and paint them red with the blood of our grapes. That would indeed be a shame, Roran replied, but sometimes you cannot avoid spilling a bit of wine when cleaning your table. Holding the horn out to one side, he tipped it over and poured what little mead remained onto the grass below. Tharos was utterly still for a moment. Even the feathers on his helm were motionless. Then with an angry snarl, he yanked his horse around and shouted at his men, "Form up! Form up, I say! Yah!" And with that final yell, he spurred his horse away from Roran, and the rest of the soldiers followed, urging their steeds to a gallop as they retraced their steps to Aros. Roran maintained his pretense of arrogance and indifference until the soldiers were well away. Then he slowly released his breath and rested his elbows on his knees. His hands were trembling slightly. It worked, he thought, amazed. He heard men running toward him from the camp, and he looked over his shoulder to see Baldur and Khan approaching, accompanied by at least 50 of the warriors who had been hiding within the tents.
You did it!
Exclaimed Baldur as they drew near.
You did it! I can't believe it!
He laughed and slapped Roran on the shoulder hard enough to knock him against the table. The other men crowded around him also laughing, as well as praising him with extravagant phrases, boasting that under his leadership they would capture Aros without so much as a single casualty, and belittling the courage and character of the city's inhabitants. Someone shoved a warm, half-full wineskin into his hand, which he stared at with unexpected loathing, and passed to the man directly to his left.
"Did you cast any spells?"
he asked Khan, his words barely audible over the hubbub of the celebrations.
"What?"
Khan leaned closer, and Roran repeated his question, whereupon the magician smiled and nodded vigorously.
"Aye, I managed to make the air shimmer as you wanted."
"And did you attack their enchanter?" When he left, he looked as if he was about to faint. Khan's smile broadened.
It was his own doing. He kept trying to break the illusion he thought I had created, to pierce the veil of shimmering air so he could see what lay behind. But there was nothing to break, nothing to pierce, so he expended all his strength in vain.
Then Roran chuckled, and his chuckle grew into a long, full-bodied laugh that rose above the excited clamour and rolled out over the fields in the direction of Aros. For several minutes he allowed himself to bask in the admiration of his men, until he heard a loud warning cry from one of the sentries stationed at the edge of the camp.
"Move aside, let me see," said Roran, and sprang to his feet.
The warriors complied, and he beheld a lone man off to the west, whom he recognized as one of the party he had sent to search the banks of the canals, riding hard over the fields, heading toward the camp.
"Have him come here," instructed Roran,
and a lanky, red-haired swordsman ran off to intercept the rider. While they waited for the man to arrive, Roran picked up the knucklebones and dropped them one by one into the leather cup. The bones made a satisfying clatter as they landed. As soon as the warrior was within hailing distance, Roran called out,
"Ho there! Is all well? Were you attacked?"
To Roran's annoyance, the man remained silent until he was only a few yards away, whereupon he jumped off his mount and presented himself before Roran,
standing as stiff and straight as a sun-starved pine, and in a loud voice exclaimed,
"Captain, sir!"
Upon closer inspection, Roran realized that the man was actually more of a boy, that in fact he was the same scraggly youth who had grabbed his reins when he had first ridden into the camp. The realization did nothing to sate Roran's frustrated curiosity, though.
"Well, what is it? I haven't got all day."
"Sir, Hammond sent me to tell you that we've found all the barges we need, and that he's building the sleds to transport them across to the other canal."
Roran nodded. "Good. Does he need any more help to get them there in time?"
"Sir, no, sir."
"And is that all?"
"Sir, yes, sir."
"You don't have to keep calling me sir. Once is enough. Understood?"
"Sir, yes, sir. I mean, yes, of course."
Roran suppressed a smile. "You've done well. Get yourself something to eat, then ride out to the mine and report back to me. I want to know what they've accomplished so far."
"Yes, sir. Sorry, sir. That is, I didn't... I'll be going at once, Captain."
Two spots of crimson appeared on the youth's cheeks as he stammered. He ducked his head in a quick bow, then hurried back to his steed and trotted off toward the tents. The visit left Roran in a more serious mood, for it reminded him that as fortunate as they were to have won a reprieve from the soldiers' blades, there was much that still needed doing, and any of the tasks that lay before them might cost them the siege if handled badly. To the warriors at large, he said,
"Back to the camp with a lot of you. I want 2 rows of trenches dug around the tents by nightfall. Those yellow-bellied soldiers might change their minds and decide to attack anyway, and I want to be prepared."
A few of the men groaned at the mention of digging trenches, but the rest appeared to accept the order with good humor. In a low voice, Khan said,
"You don't want to tire them out too much before tomorrow."
"I know," Roran replied, also in a soft tone. "But the camp needs fortifying, and it'll help keep them from brooding. Besides, no matter how worn out they may be tomorrow, battle will give them new strength. It always does." The day passed quickly for Roran when he was concentrating on some immediate problem or occupied with intense physical exertion, and slowly, whenever his mind was free to ponder their situation. His men worked valiantly. By saving them from the soldiers, he had won their loyalty and devotion in a way that words never could. But it seemed ever more obvious to him that despite their efforts, they would not be able to finish the preparations in the brief span of hours that remained. All through the late morning, afternoon, and early evening, a sense of sick hopelessness grew within Roran, and he cursed himself for deciding upon such a complicated and ambitious plan. "I should have known from the start that we didn't have time for this," he thought. But it was too late to try some other scheme. The only option left was to strive their utmost and hope that somehow it would be enough to wrest victory from the mistakes of his incompetence. When dusk arrived, a faint spark of optimism leavened his pessimism. For all of a sudden, the preparations began to come together with unexpected speed. And a few hours later, when it was fully dark and the stars shone bright overhead, he found himself standing by the mills along with almost 700 of his men, having completed all of the arrangements needed if they were to capture Aros before the end of the following day. Roran uttered a short laugh of relief, pride, and incredulousness as he gazed upon the object of their toils. Then he congratulated the warriors around him and bade them return to their tents. "Rest now while you can. We attack at dawn." And the men cheered, despite their evident exhaustion.
My friend, my enemy. That night, Roran's sleep was shallow and troubled. It was impossible for him to entirely relax, knowing the importance of the upcoming battle, and that he might very well be wounded during the fighting, as he often had been before. Those two thoughts caused a line of vibrating tension to form between his head and the base of his spine, a line that pulled him out of his dark, weird dreams at regular intervals. As a result, he woke easily when a soft, dull thud sounded outside his tent. He opened his eyes and stared at the panel of fabric above his head. The interior of the tent was barely visible, and only because of the faint line of orange torchlight that seeped through the gap between the flaps at the entrance. The air felt cold and dead against his skin, as if he were buried in a cave deep underground. Whatever the time, it was late, very late. Even the animals of the night would have returned to their lairs and gone to sleep. No one ought to be up, save the sentinels, and the sentinels were stationed nowhere near his tent. Roran kept his breathing as slow and shallow as he could, while he listened for any other noises. The loudest thing he heard was the beating of his own heart, which grew stronger and faster as the line of tension within him thrummed like a plucked lute string. A minute passed, then another. Then just when he began to think there was no cause for alarm, and the hammering in his veins began to slow, a shadow fell across the front of the tent, blocking the light from the torches beyond. Roran's pulse tripled, his heart pounding as hard as if he were running up the side of a mountain. Whoever was there could not have come to rouse him for the assault on Aros, nor to bring him some piece of intelligence, for they would not have hesitated to call his name and barge inside. A black-gloved hand, only a shade darker than the surrounding murk, slid between the entrance flaps and groped for the tie that held them closed. Roran opened his mouth to raise the alarm, then changed his mind. It would be foolish to waste the advantage of surprise. Besides, if the intruder knew he had been spotted, he might panic, and panic could make him even more dangerous. With his right hand, Roran carefully pulled his dagger from under the rolled-up cloak he used as a pillow, and hid the weapon by his knee, beneath a fold in the blanket. At the same time, he grasped the edge of the blankets with his other hand. A rim of golden light outlined the shape of the intruder as he slipped into the tent. Roran saw that the man was wearing a padded leather jerkin, but no plate or mail armor. Then the flap fell shut, and darkness enveloped them again. The faceless figure crept toward where Roran lay. Roran felt as if he was going to pass out from lack of air as he continued to restrict his breathing so that it would appear he was still asleep. When the intruder was halfway to the cot, Roran tore his blankets off, threw them over the man, and with a wild yell leaped toward him, drawing back the dagger to stab him in the gut. "Wait!" cried the man. Surprised, Roran stayed his hand, and the two of them crashed to the ground together. "Friend! I'm a friend!" A half-second later, Roran gasped as he felt two hard blows to his left kidney. The pain nearly incapacitated him, but he forced himself to roll away from the man, trying to put some distance between them. Roran pushed himself to his feet, then he again charged at his attacker, who was still struggling to free himself from the blanket. "Wait, I'm your friend!" cried the man, but Roran was not about to trust him a second time. It was well he did not, for as he slashed at the intruder, the man trapped Roran's right arm and dagger with a twirl of the blankets, then slashed at Roran with a knife he had produced from his jerkin. There was a faint tugging sensation across Roran's chest, but it was so slight he paid it no mind. Roran bellowed and yanked on the blanket as hard as he could, pulling the man off his feet and throwing him against one side of the tent, which collapsed on top of them, trapping them under the heavy wool. Roran shook the twisted blanket off his arm, then crawled toward the man, feeling his way through the darkness. The hard sole of a boot struck Roran's left hand, and the tips of his fingers went numb. Lunging forward, Roran caught the man by an ankle as he was trying to turn to face him head-on. The man kicked like a rabbit and broke Roran's grip, but Roran grabbed his ankle again and squeezed it through the thin leather, digging his fingers into the tendon at the back of the heel until the man roared in pain. Before he could recover, Roran clawed his way up the man's body and pinned his knife hand to the ground. Roran tried to drive his dagger into the man's side, but he was too slow. His opponent found his wrist and seized it with a grip of iron.
"Who are you?"
Roran growled.
"I'm your friend,"
the man said, his breath warm in Roran's face. It smelled like wine and mulled cider. Then he kneed Roran in the ribs 3 times in quick succession. Roran bashed his forehead against the assassin's nose, breaking it with a loud snap. The man snarled and thrashed underneath him, but Roran refused to let him go.
"You're no friend of mine,"
said Roran, grunting as he bore down on his right arm and slowly pushed the dagger toward the man's side. As they strained against one another, Roran was vaguely aware of people shouting outside the fallen tent. At last, the man's arm buckled, and with sudden ease, the dagger plunged through his jerkin and into the softness of living flesh. The man convulsed. Fast as he could, Roran stabbed him several more times, then buried the dagger in his chest. Through the hilt of the dagger, Roran felt the bird-like flutters of the man's heart as it cut itself to pieces on the razor-sharp blade. Twice more the man shuddered and jerked, then ceased resisting and simply lay there panting. Roran continued to hold him as the life drained out of him, their embrace as intimate as any lover's. Though the man had tried to kill him, and though Roran knew nothing about him besides that fact, he could not help but feel a sense of terrible closeness to him. Here was another human being, another living, thinking creature, whose life was ending because of what he had done.
"Who are you?" he whispered. "Who sent you?"
I almost killed you," said the man, sounding perversely satisfied.
Then he uttered a long, hollow sigh. His body went limp, and he was no more. Roran let his head fall forward against the man's chest and gasped for air, shaking from head to toe as the shock of the attack racked his limbs. People began to pull at the fabric resting on top of him.
"Get it off me!"
Roran shouted, and lashed out with his left arm, unable to bear any longer the oppressive weight of the wool and the darkness and the cramped space and the stifling air. A rent appeared in the panel above him as someone cut through the wool. Warm, flickering torchlight poured through the opening. Frantic to escape his confinement, Roran lurched to his feet, grabbed at the edges of the slit, and dragged himself out of the collapsed tent. He staggered into the light, wearing nothing but his breeches, and looked round in confusion. Baldur was standing there, as were Khan, Delwyn, Mandel, and 10 other warriors, all of whom held swords and axes at the ready. None of the men were fully dressed, save for 2, whom Roran recognized as sentinels posted on the night watch.
"Gods!"
someone exclaimed, and Roran turned to see one of the warriors peeling back the side of the ruined tent to expose the corpse of the assassin. The dead man was of an unimposing size, with long shaggy hair gathered in a ponytail, and a leather patch mounted over his left eye. His nose was crooked and squashed flat, broken by Roran, and a mask of blood covered the lower part of his shaved face. More blood caked his chest and side and the ground beneath him. It appeared almost too much to have come from a single person. "Roran," said Baldur. Roran continued to stare at the assassin, unable to tear his gaze away.
"Roran!"
Baldur said again, but louder.
"Roran, listen to me! Are you hurt? What happened? Roran!"
The concern in Baldur's voice finally caught Roran's attention.
"What?"
he asked.
"Roran, are you hurt?"
Why would he think that? Puzzled, Roran looked down at himself. The hair on his torso was matted with gore from top to bottom, while streaks of blood covered his arms and stained the upper part of his breeches.
"I'm fine,"
he said, though he had difficulty forming the words.
"Has anyone else been attacked?"
In response, Delwyn and Hammond moved apart, revealing a slumped body. It was the youth who had been running messages for him earlier.
"Ah,"
groaned Roran, and sorrow filled him.
"What was he doing wandering about?"
One of the warriors stepped forward.
"I shared a tent with him, Captain. He always had to step out to relieve himself at night because he drank so much tea before turning in. His mother told him it would keep him from getting sick. He was a good sort, Captain. He didn't deserve to be cut down from behind by some sneaking coward."
"No, he didn't," Roran murmured. "If he hadn't been there, I would be dead now." He motioned toward the assassin.
"Are there any more of these killers on the loose?"
The men stirred, glancing at each other. Then Baldur said,
"I don't think so."
"Have you checked?"
"No."
"Well then check. But try not to wake up everyone else. They need their sleep. And see to it the guards are stationed at the tents of all the commanders from now on." "Should have thought of that before." Roran stayed where he was, feeling dull and stupid, as Baldur issued a series of quick orders,